As it's the Easter weekend, we weren't originally going to release an episode this week. However, after a very kind invitation from Jacob, who you may remember from a couple of weeks ago on the Yes Music podcast, we recorded an episode with him for his podcast, and he's very kindly given us permission to play it on the Yes Music podcast this week.
Hello, everybody. This is Jacob, also known as Big Yellow Praxis. I am here with another episode about underrated music. This is a podcast where I talk very generally, well, sometimes specifically, I guess, with people about music that I think is underrated or overhated. I'm not the best at coming up with imaginative names, so I've just named the podcast Underrated Overhated. So this episode, I am joined by Mark and Kevin from the Yes Music podcast, who I assume it is the longest running Yes Music podcast, but I'll let them introduce themselves because I know it's coming up to their 10th anniversary. Kevin and Mark, it's down to you.
Hello there. Yes, I'm Kevin, and Mark is with me as well over in Canada. Hello, Mark.
Hello, Kevin. How are you doing today?
I'm doing fine, thank you. So here we are on a different podcast. And yes, about the Yes Music podcasts. So I started the Yes Music podcast in 2011, when the world was a very different place, I suppose. So we're coming up to the 10th anniversary, as you've said, Jacob, and we're having a special event for the 10th anniversary, which, fingers crossed, is going to actually take place. Who knows what lockdown situation we'll be in by then. It's in August of this year, and we're going to Yes Tour in Devon, and we're going to record the 500th episode of the podcast from the top of Yes Tour in Devon. And the reason for that is, if you're scratching your head and wondering why that would be, is that my favourite Yes album is Tormato, and that was originally going to be called Yes Tour, that album, not Tormato at all, and it features artwork of the band. It looks like they're standing. They're not actually, but it looks like they're standing in front of Yes Tour. So that's where they're going to go and do a little pilgrimage to Yes Tour to record the 500th episode later this year. So, Mark, when did you join as actual co-host?
That's actually a very good question, because I was trying to figure that out myself, and it's been a while since I've been on here. But I mean, I actually started out by submitting some of my reviews. I remember I sent in a Rick Wakeman review of one of the records. I just think it was, I don't remember which one it was, but it's like Time Traveler, one of those records from, like, you know, that 80s period where people were kind of like just rolling their eyes whenever you mentioned the name Rick Wakeman. So I reviewed a couple of those records, and, you know, Kevin liked them. He would read them on the show. And I started, you know, putting these little guest host spots in where I would pop in every once in a while and talk about things with them. And then Kevin messaged me and asked if I wanted to co-host, and I was blown away, because I loved listening to this podcast. I was listening to it from almost near the beginning. So to become involved in it permanently was just honestly a dream come true. I don't want to, you know, make it sound like I'm kissing his rear end or something, but I honestly am very honored to be involved with it, because it's such a great podcast. I've met so many great people. I had the pleasure also of bringing in some people that I knew, like Billy Sherwood, into the fold. That helped out the podcast quite a bit. And, you know, it's turned out splendidly well, as they would say overseas.
Absolutely. Yes, it's been great to have you, Mark.
Yeah. Thank you.
So I just wanted to note a few things there. You've already briefly touched upon the subject of this episode, which is album covers, and secondly, that's an impressively controversial decision as your favorite Yes album. And I like the controversy. Yeah. That you've rolled with it there. I really like it.
Well, there is a story behind that. Anyone who listens to the podcast has heard it many times, but very briefly, it was one of the two first Yes albums I heard. Mine gave me a tape, which he taped from his brother's records, and on one side was 90125, the 1983 album, and on the other side was Tormato. So it was the first, you know, classic sounding, whatever your views are on that, Yes album I'd ever heard, and my mind was very firmly blown by it. I liked the 80s 90125 stuff, but Tormato really pointed me in the right direction, and then from there I found out everything about the band.
Nice, very nice. So we are, I briefly pointed out there, In this episode, we're going to talk about album covers. This is not something I've talked about much in my podcast episodes so far, but I think it's super important. It's a super important of the music we listen to, and it's maybe less important in the days of Spotify, and it probably was less important during the age of CDs than it was in the age of vinyl. But I still think it's important. I don't want to preamble too much because I'm sure like random discussion points will come up as we go through the choices. But basically, we've each chosen two album covers and a couple songs from each album that we like. And we just kind of talk through, I guess, what we like about the album cover in and of itself and kind of the relationship between it and the music of the album it's actually for. So I'm just going to throw it out there and throw it to one of you two to start. So I'm going to throw it straight to, sorry to put you on the spot, Mark, do you want to choose one of yours? Are we going to talk about that first?
Absolutely, and there's no worries here. I picked two album covers that have greatly affected me the very first time I saw them. Let's go with the first one that I selected, and that is Genesis Nursery Crime. Now, I remember the very first time I saw that album cover, I was like, what the heck is going on here? They're playing croquet with some heads on the ground here. I thought it very interesting artwork and an interesting choice, and I think In essence, this is what album artwork is supposed to do, kind of make you kind of, you know, when you're walking down the aisle, to kind of stop and go, whoa, what the heck is that? Turn around, look back and pick it up and say, wow, what are these guys thinking of? And then you flip the back and you notice that there's even more artwork connected to it. And then right away for me, that was like the fishing lure to like go in and buy this record, because I'm like, what is this? I'm looking at their musical box, the return of the giant hogweed, and all this stuff. I'm like, this sounds very interesting. And I was at that point starting to get right into my progressive rock phase, which I'm still in now, like 20, 30 years later. So I love this type of stuff. So as soon as I saw this artwork, it connected me right away to it. And the song that I did select actually as the song, like a point of talking later, is The Return of the Giant Hogweed.
Yeah, it's a great choice for a song. I've actually briefly talked about the song in a previous podcast of mine where I got a friend who studied science at university, and we went through a bunch of songs that like ostensibly talk about science and kind of rated them on like their scientific accuracy. And I think his conclusion was like, not necessarily the most accurate, but definitely a great song. I really like the song, and it really kind of encapsulates that kind of wacky yet sophisticated style of Genesis, and I think the album cover does the same. And interestingly, I have a friend who, she always says that she doesn't like Genesis album covers because they're just too creepy for her, which I, again, is something I totally get. I can't really disagree, but there's something about the whimsy and the fantasy side that it really just matches the music, and in and of itself, I think, you know, it's great stuff. But did you have anything specific to say about, like, I don't know, the song? Because it's not one of my favorite songs, but I really do enjoy it. It's great fun.
Yeah, well, I mean, the thing about the song that I like about it from a guitar player's perspective is that it's very, it's technically challenging, but not, like, impossible from a guitar player's point of view. And also, it points out a very important thing that's been, you know, I'm not sure how big you are into the whole guitarist circle of things, and you know how people debate about certain things within the music community, but there was always the great debate of who started the two-handed tapping thing in the guitar world, and everybody's saying, you know, Edward Van Halen, you know, Eruption is the starting point. And I'm just keep thinking of myself, nah, you know, if you go back and you watch the early live footage of this song, Steve Hackett is clearly doing a tapping technique at the beginning of this song, and this is like 72 71, around there. So that predates Edward a long time beforehand, you know. And then, you know, people also said, you know, well, ZZ Top, but that was just like one little ridiculous note he just did. He probably just did it by accident, probably.
Have you ever seen the video of Chet Atkins employing a bit of tapping, though? I don't know whether that's in like the 60s or something. And it blew my mind when I saw it. it's a totally different style, obviously. It's like country.
Yeah, no, I didn't see it. And I guess the point is the same that we're trying to make with those examples is that, you know, some of these things could have even been done, you know, who knows, by some guy and some bloke in the 1800s on an acoustic guitar by accident. So, you know, who did it first, I think, is unimportant. It's how the technique is used within the music, I think, that's more important. And I think it makes a great example of how a guitar can play with a keyboard player and have such a similarly kind of interesting sound that they can put together. That's why I've always liked this song. And one of the things about Genesis back at this time, and I'm curious to get your comments on this, Jacob, is I always thought that Peter Gabriel back at this time was so focused on the lyrics that he wrote that he didn't edit himself very much. And this is why you got kind of those lyrics and those melodies in his songs where he's like, he won't get a word out of there. And so you have these really, really overblown lyrics in there. And, you know, later on, I think once he started getting producers in like Daniel Lenoir to help him, I think they probably said, listen, Peter, you might want to cut a few of these words out and actually give us some decent melodies. Because I think at this point, he was so focused on the story that he didn't want to cut any of it out. What are your thoughts on that?
I think I'm inclined to agree. And it's not... I think it's an unedited wordiness. And I think like almost like the counter example would be like Joni Mitchell, who's very wordy in her songs. Like you listen to like line by line, there's so many words and syllables, but that's a very conscious, it's almost like literary from her. And I'm not trying to say she's inherently much better as a lyricist than what Peter Gabriel became. But early on, Peter Gabriel, to me, yeah, there is a lot of that. And that is part of the fun, I think. But I do agree. What about you, Kevin? Do you tend to agree as well?
Yeah, I think I do. And it's interesting, there's a little parallel between that and the song that I'm going to talk about later and the style of John Anderson, actually, because he does tend to do that as well. He tends to just ignore the meter or whatever of the lyrics and of the music and just sticks in all the words that he wants to and words that don't necessarily make sense, but fit with the mood of the music and so on. And I do like that. That's actually the first time, and people are going to hit the roof when I say this, but it's the first time that I've heard Return of the Giant Hogweed. I've heard a lot of other Genesis material over the years.
Wow.
And I know, yeah. And but it's very enjoyable. But I was just going to say about the cover there. I think you're right. It's whimsical, but I think it's particularly English in its whimsy, and I think that's what the music does evoke to me as well. It's mm-hmm. It's a very English style, it seems mm-hmm. to me. And if you think of something like Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, where they play croquet with hedgehogs, that's a very similar idea. And that kind of surrealism, I think, stems from a lot of English literary and musical work before it, and flows into music after it as well. And I suppose a lot of the roots of progressive music are in English music, and mm-hmm. you know, then it spreads out to Italy and various other places around the world, the US and so on. But I think in essence, it's an English form. So that's why I like to see this artwork on the front of Genesis. Although, you know, I don't necessarily like it as artwork. It doesn't offend the same way as Roger Dean or whatever, but yes, you can see why they did it. It does the music very well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think actually this is probably a good place then for us to segue into talking about the John Anderson album, because it's quite a different, it's fantastical still, but it's a different style of music. I mean, it's still progressive rock, but it's still quite different, and the art is definitely different. So
yeah.
So this, you'll be better at introducing it than I will be. But all I know is that it's not Roger Dean, which is what I would assume in a way because of Roger Dean's art with Yes. But I know nothing about it. So do you want to introduce it? Because I think it's a great
album. Yeah. So I've chosen Elias of Sun Hilo, which is topical at the moment because they're just releasing a new version, a new revamped version, and all sorts of things done to it in a new patch, and it looks beautiful with the original artwork on there. I think it's only a CD, but I could be wrong about that. Anyway, of course, that's, as you were mentioning earlier, Jacob, it's from the Age of Vinyl, 1976, and it was at the point of Yes where they decided to all go off and do a solo album. And unlike the other members of the band, so you had Fish Out of Water, which is another fantastic album, solo album by Chris Squire, and Ramshackle, which is interesting, not as good perhaps, by Alan White, Beginnings by Steve Howe, and The Story of I by Patrick Mraz, who was in the band briefly at that stage, but very importantly at that stage. So yes, they did do what Jonathan did with Hello, which was Mike Oldfield. He played all the instruments. He wrote everything. He sang all the vocal parts. And so it really is, you know, the essence of a solo album. There wasn't anybody else involved with the music at all. He did have help with some mixing and production and those sorts of things, but every part of the music is entirely down to him and the concept of the album. And it's a really progressive concept album. And again, the truest form, because it tells a story. It could be staged as an opera, I suppose, a rock opera in the same way as Tommy or something like that. But it's a fantastical idea of these four races of people on a planet who have to escape the planet because there's been a cataclysmic eruption, and they've got to get off the planet. And so they and they build this vehicle called the Moonglaive. I knew I'd say that wrong. The Moorglade Mover, which is a kind of, it looks a bit like a combination of an animal and a ship, a Viking ship or something like that. And they build that and they escape the world and they travel to a new world all together, and it's all very harmonic and so on at the end. And there is a story that the reason it isn't Roger Dean artwork is because Anderson asked him many times, but he was too busy apparently to commit to designing what is a gatefold sleeve, but it has all sorts of different portraits and pieces of artwork on it, and the sleeve is again highly designed in the same way. So yes, he had to go to an artist by the name of David Fairbrother Rowe, who was suggested by, and I think that what he comes up with is actually perfect. It's reminiscent, I suppose, of something that Roger Dean would have done if he'd been able to. But I do think it captures the sort of imaginative force and the fairy tale science fiction aspects of it. It's I don't know what it's like. It's designed on the front and back of it as if it was some kind of an album, you know, of a storybook, a fantasy storybook. Mm-hmm. And inside it, there's the whole of the story written out by John. And it's an incredible piece of work. And in terms of how it fits with the music, the funny thing about Elias is that it doesn't sound very much like anything else. It's got elements of Yes in it. It's got elements of Vangelis and that kind of keyboard wizardry of the time, but it's not really like anything else. And I suppose the vocal harmony, but like some Yes harmonies that John Anderson did for Fragile, where he did a song called We Have Heaven, which has all sorts of layered harmonies on it. And they're similar to that, but they don't sound the same. It couldn't be a Yes album. It doesn't have a lot of the factors that Yes albums have. And the song from it that I chose as a kind of perfect one for it is the flight of the Moorglade, which is the point in the story where they get off the planet and they fly somewhere else. And there's even, I'm sorry I'm going on about this a bit, but there's even a big parallel between the story here and the artwork here and what Roger Dean did for Yes, because on Fragile, if you have a look at that cover, that's the beginning of a story about a planet which disintegrates, sort of a fragile planet which disintegrates, and bits of it fly off, sort of T-shaped sections of it fly off into the universe. And then on other album covers like Yes Songs, some of those bits of the original planet land on different planets and start growing and getting integrated into the environment there. So all sorts of fantastical and amazing connections. And it is a fabulous work. And as I say, unique, I think, in progressive or any other music.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I totally agree. I think it's great. So I had a few thoughts there. Almost like his approach, John Anderson's approach here, if it reminds me of anyone, I don't think it necessarily sounds like them musically, but the approach is, I think it's not surprising because he's not the most technically accomplished instrumentalist in the world. That I'm going to compare him to two other people who are brilliant but not technically accomplished musicians. And they're kind of the two brilliant Brians of production. Brian Eno, who his albums don't sound like this, but there's a similar kind of building it up piece by piece. And it's not like there's not an amazing guitar part necessarily, but the guitar part with the bass, with the drums, all layers up. And the other Brian, who I always mention in this podcast because I love him, Brian Wilson, has a similar approach where, again, not necessarily sounding much like it aesthetically immediately, but that kind of similar complex parts are kind of spread across instruments and it's building up layer by layer. And I feel like...
Wouldn't it be nice, dude?
I mean, that's a brilliant song. I love it. I love it. You just, it's like you singing it to me there. It's like the voice of an angel. I love it.
I think
John Anderson is probably, he's not channeling them necessarily, but he's probably in a similar mode of like, I have, you know, he's very much, he clearly has a vision. And I always saw him as a kind of visionary heart, beating heart of yes, which is what I really love about John Anderson. This kind of links
he says the process, he says the process nearly killed him. Because he shut himself away because he was so worried that, exactly as you say, he wasn't seen as and didn't consider himself to be a great instrumentalist or you know, from that point of view. But so he shut himself away and wouldn't let anyone else hear the music until he was absolutely happy with it.
That's the point I was going to make, too, is that I think the reason why there has never been a follow-up to this is because while he keeps claiming that he's going to be doing it and he's working on it, I think secretly in the back of his mind, I don't think that he wants to do another one, because the amount of stress it was on his life doing this. I mean, could you imagine thinking to yourself, I'm going to go through this again to complete another record? I just don't think that he wants to do that same thing over again. I mean, Kevin mentioned that he didn't let anybody listen to it. I mean, there's a record of it saying that he didn't even let his wife hear it, and he didn't even let Ahmet Erdogan, who was president of Atlantic Records, hear it. And that was one of his biggest supporters. Like he backed, he let them do anything they wanted. So for him not to let Ahmet Erdogan listen to it, I mean, something was going on with John. But then, you know, I think for the last 30 years, something's been going on with John. But, you know, he's an interesting character to say the least. And, you know, I love the record. I mean, if you don't mind me giving my two cents on the record
Go ahead.
I think the artwork is fantastic. I love the kind of booklet that comes in with it. I mean, certain pressings, they have it constructed in a certain way where you can, like, it's like stapled into the album and there's like a little separate booklet within the album that kind of goes through the whole story. I think it's fantastic. It's a brilliant idea. It shows how much commitment he had to the story as well, to have that put into the album jacket. And the music to me is really meditative, I find. It borders on, like, you know, if I need to just chill out after a stressful day, putting on Elias of Sun Hilo is probably one of the best records you can put on in that capacity. And I think that he did a great job. The fact that it was just him playing on this is just incredible. Because, I mean, while it's nothing overly complex, there's a lot of tracks on there. I mean, I think I read somewhere that they said there was almost 100 tracks used to make the album. So that's like, that's a ridiculous amount of, you know, recording done overall to do it. I mean, he doesn't have a 100-track machine. I think what they meant is that they did like 24 tracks overall through the whole album, right? Of recording. So but that's a lot of recording, and for one person to do it. And I mean, myself, who I make my own music as well, called Project Gemini, I do everything by myself as well. And, you know, I know how it is to do everything from scratch and to do every last instrumentation, vocal, mixing, everything. It's a lot of work. And if you like doing it, then it's fun. But if it ends up being something where you're pulling your hair out and you want to, you know, throttle yourself at the end, I guess you don't want to have to do those kind of records all the time. So I think that's why later on he made some little bit more, you know, easier records to make than Elias, like Animation, you know, Song of Seven and stuff like that. They're all great records, but I don't think he ever returned to this level of songwriting and like lyric writing.
I agree. Now, I just have to say, I shouldn't be surprised that the two Yes Music podcasters have a lot to say about a Yes member solo album. But I totally agree. I totally agree with everything you're saying. But I was going to make one other point, and then we'll move on, because I think we've chosen a lot. When we get to the other albums we've chosen, it'll be clear they're quite progressive in nature for the most part. But I've also heard people say regarding progressive rock that the I guess the success of a progressive rock band is largely dependent on like how successful the world they create for themselves is, you know, whether they're in a sci-fi world or a fantasy world. And Yes, for example, are always a little bit sci-fi and a bit fantasy. Whether it's Genesis, very English, very fairy tale, Caravana, whimsical and Tolkien-esque, I guess. You know, they've all got their own little world, and I think that's a key important part of progressive rock album or band. And I think John Anderson does a great job here. I really do think he does a great job of the entire package, creating this like cool little world. And you know, I really like it for it. I have to say. I think it's time to go into one of my choices. So I think the first one we'll go to for my choices is the Van Morrison album, Hard Knows the Highway, which is an album I really like. I really like Van Morrison. In fact, someone who shared a kitchen with me when I was at university would probably argue that I like Van Morrison maybe a little bit too much. He now says that he just cannot listen to Van Morrison because I listened to him too much whilst at university. Andrew, if you are listening, I apologize. I'm very sorry. But I still love Van Morrison and I always will. So this album cover was by someone called Rob Springett, who I've researched him a bit. He doesn't seem to have done lots of albums covers beyond this. He did a few for Herbie Hancock. And they're always, you know, good album covers, but he seems to have largely disappeared by the mid-70s. And, you know, when I Google him and look for him, there are other people on forums saying, you know, what happened to this guy? So unfortunately, I can't really say much beyond this, a few Herbie Hancock albums, and they're really the most famous ones. But the song I chose as well from this album is Snow in San Anselmo. It's a bit of a tongue twister for me, that name. I love the song. I love the album cover. But I guess for you guys, and either of you can take it first, I'm curious what your thoughts are on the song itself, or Van Morrison generally. And also, maybe I should just say what I think, actually. I love the song. I've already said that. I love Van Morrison. I don't think the album cover matches the music at all, although I do like the album cover. I'm quite curious what your either of your thoughts are on any of the things I've just said.
Yes, first time I'd heard this, I know the Van Morrison hits, but beyond that, I have not heard any, I don't think, Van Morrison's of album tracks and so on, and I don't know a lot about his range and breadth. What I did think about this song is it's a very good song, and I very much appreciate Van Morrison's singing on this, particularly. I think his vocal style is remarkable, and you know, it's one of those people like John Anderson that you can tell it's Van Morrison, it couldn't be anyone else.
Yes.
The arrangement is really odd. Now, you may know a lot more about this than I do, but the choir is a very strange and almost ill-fitting part of the song, and certainly at the beginning they seem to be singing out of tune for some reason. It's a very strange choral arrangement, and whether the artwork fits the song, I suppose not. I mean, the artwork is quite surreal, isn't it? So you've got cows with blue and white on them, like clouds in the sky or something, and very strange enigmatic characters and some seagulls and cliffs and things. And it's very, very good artwork, but again, yes, I agree with you. It doesn't seem to fit the music, which is, you know, remarkable but very odd, I thought. What about you, Mark?
Yeah, I mean, I'll be totally honest. I mean, you can hear me, right?
Yes, yeah, we can. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So, hearing this for the first time, and I'll be totally honest, I know zero about Van Morrison, and I kind of realized why. And this is not to be, rude or anything.
All opinions are welcomed. To be honest.
Okay. So, if there's one thing that people who listen to our podcast will definitely say is I am nothing if but honest about my opinions. And that is that when I first heard this song, I thought that if I wouldn't have known who Van Morrison actually is, I would have thought this was an African American singer. He has a very kind of bluesy kind of tone to his singing, first saw the cover to this, I saw the cover before I listened to a note of this music. I thought to myself, "Oh, okay, this is probably going to be someone in these really obscure, you know, Bandcamp prog finds that you know okay, yes. you're lucky that you find, you know, and it's like one of these pressings that you'll probably like get like 1 of 100, like how I do my stuff, like." Something really obscure and odd. Because I looked at the cover, I'm like, wow, this is a really cool cover. I really actually enjoyed the album cover. Mm-hmm. I thought that it was excellent done. It definitely does those things that I mentioned before that I love album covers when they do it correctly, do like lure me in. When I look at this cover, I was like, wow, this is really odd. And the title too, Hard Knows the Highway. I was like, what is that supposed to mean? There's not a highway in sight here.
Yeah.
You know? And, you know, so I was kind of trying to figure out the title in the connection to the artwork. And sometimes there is none, which I'm guessing maybe that's what there is here. But I mean, I'm not an expert on Van Morrison and the artwork involved with him. So maybe there is. But when I listened to the song, I thought, again, it was interesting. It was a very, like, very different from what I thought it was going to be. I was like, whoa, this is not what this album cover transmitted to me. So that's one of these things I'll tell you right now that I'm big about. I think that the cover and music should be a connection, because otherwise you have something like this that happens. You're a guy like me who runs over to the store, sees this album cover and says, oh man, this is fantastic. I'm going to go buy it. You snap it up. You drop whatever, $20 Canadian for it, bring it home. You put it on your turntable and you're like, ooh, what is this? Oh my God. Why did and you kind of get like, not disappointed. I mean, I'm sure there's lots of people who love Van Morrison who probably think that I'm off my rocker saying that. But, you know, it's just not what I expected. Musically, it's fine. I mean, I think it's recorded well. Mm-hmm. I think he did a good performance of it. Yeah, there's little technical things like Kevin brought up, like maybe he's not entirely in tune in spots and stuff like that. But I think overall the performance is interesting. The choir is interesting. There's horns in this too, if I remember correctly. And it's just a fantastic sort of how do I put this? It's a sort of a unexpected arrangement of a song for this type of you know, for the artwork. I mean, I look at it and I expect one thing and I get something totally different.
Yeah, totally. I tend to agree that it's not the best example of, and that's why I chose it, of artwork matching the music. And for me, the best example that I can think of the artwork matching the music was when I was younger, my brother went into a CD shop. So I must have been about 14, and I think he was probably 15 or 16. And he just bought an album based solely on the artwork, brought it home. And the album was Magna Carta, Lord of the Ages, and it's a Roger Dean artwork. And I don't think he knew that necessarily at the time, but obviously we already knew Roger Dean and liked his artwork. And I think it's a really good album. I really like it. And that is one of those things where sometimes you can buy something based solely on the artwork and it works out fine, and it did there. But I think you're right. This album would mislead a lot of people. Van Morrison generally, I would say, I mean, I really like him, but he's very much not prog. I've never come across a songwriter who has managed to so successfully, for me personally, eke out a career on so few chords. I mean, every song is essentially 3 or 4 chords, which for a lot of people would not work. And for me personally, for Van Morrison, I'm into it. I'm into it all the way. His voice is just, it just hits the right notes for me, and I think it's great. But yeah, definitely not for everyone. He is very much, as you say, Mark, like, he's a soulful, bluesy singer. He's not necessarily the most concerned about hitting notes perfectly, but it's more about the kind of the charisma and the feel. Yeah, the feel, exactly. But I think he's great. So I think it's perfect time to move on to the next album cover and album. And I think we should go, we'll keep going around in the same order. I think we'll go back to Mark for your second choice. Over to you.
All right. So my second choice is one that's going to be not very surprising to people who listen to our podcast, because of course it's yes related this time. I wanted to have one non-yes related and one yes related. So I picked a gentleman that, of course, has a long history with the band, and he's actually a person that I collect a vast amount of his material on vinyl. I'm one of these guys who has like 9 pressings of his first record, 15 different pressings of his second record, and that's of course Rick Wakeman. And the album that I selected is The Six Wives of King Henry the Eighth, right? Or 7th? I don't remember.
8th.
8th.
Yeah, 8th.
Hey, you see, yeah. if you were British, though, the six wives would be ingrained upon your skull for all time.
and considering how many pressings of the album I have, I'm surprised I didn't know that off the top of my head, because I have like, you know, 9 versions of it, including a test pressing thing too.
Oh wow!
For me, this album has very interesting art to it, because I mean it's very sort of historic looking. But of course, being Rick Wakeman, he had to just, of course, plop himself in the middle of this photograph, you know, to make it like a little non-historic, you know, having him in there. But I like the way it's constructed in the sense that he has the pictures of the wives in the back with a little write-up about each one, when they were born, when they were died, you know, what happened, their story within their life with the king, right? And the other thing that I love as well, being that this is a gatefold, is when you open the album, inside is a nice big picture of him amongst his keyboards, and it has a nice detailed thing of what each keyboard in the photograph is. The Mini Moog, the Mellotron, the piano, you know, it has everything kind of laid out, and for each song, it has who played what on it. Now, of course, this is all instrumental stuff with the occasional, you know, choir bit here and there. And of course, the great thing about this record that happens, and it happens, you know, once or twice, I think, down the line in his discography, is that he has, you know, people like, you know, Bill Bruford on the record. He has Chris Squire on his song. He has Steve Howe on his song. So there is elements of Yes within it as well. And the song that I picked from it is the opener, Catherine of Aragon. So that's one of my favorite songs. And that song, of course, has Chris Squire all over it. Like, you can definitely hear his bass playing in amongst that. And the great thing about this record, too, is that while he's known as a prog keyboardist through and through, he doesn't have very many, like, you know, 11-minute songs on this record. A lot of them are like 3 minutes, 4 minutes. And they're well-constructed, they're well-played. And I'm not, and believe it or not, I'm not a big instrumental album guy. I know that's probably shocking to some people, but I do like prog that has vocals to it. So, but he makes records that I can listen to no problem with no vocals, because I think a lot of his keyboard playing and his soloing are so melodic that it almost takes the place of a vocalist when he does that as well. And I mean, the thing that I also find striking about this record, I'm not sure how many people are aware of this. I'm sure plenty are if you're in the Yes world, but how many non-Yes people know this? But this album sold ridiculous. I think it was something like 20 million copies of this album sold. I mean, and at the time, A&M Records, I released it, we were overjoyed. But, you know, this is another great example of where record labels can sometimes get a little off their rocker. You know, they 3 records later, he releases an album. I think it was King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table. I think it sold like 15 million copies, and they had a big emergency meeting about how record sales had slipped. So I can't believe that you would actually have a meeting about only selling 15 million albums. You know, I think that was a different time period in the music business. But
yes,
But in terms of the artwork, I think this fits perfectly with the music, because again, when you're listening to it, it's very sort of very British, very hinting at that time period. The piano playing is fantastic. I mean, one thing is for certain, Rick Wakeman is probably hands down one of the best piano players that this planet has ever seen. And when you kind of look at this artwork and listen to the music, you're kind of drawn into this whole kind of British monarchy world, and listening to it is such a joy when you have these kind of things to look at as well. I think it's a really important artwork, is to make the audio experience even more interesting and exciting by having those visuals to look at while you listen.
Yeah, and I was just going to briefly say that Rick Wakeman, as a pianist and keyboard player, there's a real dynamism to his playing that goes beyond just being able to play really fast. You know, playing really fast is obviously cool, and there's a time and a place for it, but he's not just that guy. And there's a real... It's like a je ne sais quoi, like that dynamism, in the same way that certain singers have it. And it's obviously, it's subjective to some degree, but I really... And I don't want to turn this into a kind of Keith Emerson versus Rick Wakeman kind of thing, but I do. I get that more personally from Rick Wakeman than I do from Keith, in spite of the fact that Keith was obviously a very dynamic performer. And I, you know, I like plenty of Keith Emerson stuff. I'm not trying to put him down at all, but Rick Wakeman for me, yeah, I really, you know, yeah. It's almost, there's just not much to say in a way, because all I'm going to say is, it'll just be me just listing superlatives or something like that. It's not very interesting in a way, is it? But Kevin, I'm sure you probably feel similarly about this record.
Yeah. There's a lot of Rick Wakeman's music that I've heard, which I don't like. That's, you know, say it up front, of his solo works. Mm-hmm. And Mark and I have discussed many times the variable quality of Rick Wakeman's output and the ridiculously large amount of his output as well. And he just seemed to retread things. And I mean, there's a story of him sitting down at the keyboard because either a piece of music had got lost or they hadn't done enough music for his Winter Olympics record. And he just sat down and improvised. Yeah, White Rock. He just sat down and improvised, you know, 7 or 8, 9 minutes of music, and then it turns up on the album. So, you know, at that end of the scale, he's quite happy to put out all sorts of various quality. But certainly the Six Wives is a fantastic record. I think it is a bit of an acquired taste. I mean, it's not just because it's instrumental, but I think the way it fits together and the way it sounds is not very obvious. It's not. You wouldn't describe it as progressive rock album. It's something a bit different, which I think is good in a lot of ways. And the cover, I think, is very interesting. I mean, you've got the sort of sheet music in the background, and I think he's trying to show the connections with the topic of the album, the sort of the idea of the portraits of the six wives, but pointing out that it's also a modern work. So there he is, as Mark said, in his trainers and his sneakers and his jeans and his shirt and whatever, walking through this scene of the king and his six wives. So it's because it's Rick Wakeman, it's funny, it's humorous, it's supposed to be humorous, and that's, you know, a lot of his character is that way inclined. So yeah, I think it's great fun to have that on the front, and this combination of historic and right bang up to date with all those instruments, which incidentally, did you see, Mark, Rick is selling off a lot of his original instruments. So if you want to get yourself an authentic Rick Wakeman Moog or whatever, then yeah, you can do that at the moment.
Yeah, I think though, in order for me to acquire some of these things, I'd have to sell a limb, or, you know, at the very least, you know, sell off like part of my home to get something. I mean, some of these things are expensive, and I mean, rightly so. I mean, I think he's selling off a Hammond organ, and some of these instruments can be like, you know, in the $30,000-$50,000 range. So, but I mean, you know, of course, I would love to get a hold of it, and if there's any rich Yes Music fan supporters out there who would want to donate the money, I would greatly appreciate it.
Yeah, shout out to anyone listening. Maybe we'll put up like a little Just Giving page for Mark. So yeah, I'll direct you there. We can all try to crowdfund a Hammond organ for him. I would say just one last kind of note on the album cover is that the kind of tonal palette is, for me, like peak 70s. It reminds me, just looking at it, it's like, oh yeah, like 70s furniture, 70s, I don't know, wallpaper. That's immediately what I think. And that's not to disparage it, but it's almost like another layer of like humor or something that I'm sure he didn't intend at the time. But now it's looking back, it's weird that it's historical, as, you know, it's about something historical, like one of the most famous historical things in British history, especially, you know, for someone who's British educated, because we all learn about the six wives. And it's also got that tongue-in-cheek modern twist. And now, because of that kind of tonal palette, and obviously because of the very nature of progressive rock, it has become a 70s historical kind of artifact.
Yeah.
It's kind of historical and modern, and it's got all this like little irony built into it now, which I don't know if I have anything sophisticated to say about it or definitive, but it just turned it into this unique thing now. But yeah, it's a very cool album cover. Thanks for suggesting that one. Kevin, what's your second choice then?
So my second choice is, again, it's got lots of Yes connections, and most obviously when you pick the album up and just look at the front cover, because it's a Roger Dean artwork, mm-hmm. and it's Ben Craven's album Great and Terrible Potions. And Ben is someone who I know quite well because he's been interviewed. We've interviewed him on the Yes Music podcast several times, and he is an Australian and just an amazing progressive rock artist in his own right. It's not his day job. He has a day job. It's his sideline, as it were, but he produces incredible cinematic pieces like this whole album, Great and Terrible Potions. And I think the reason that he managed to afford, as it were, Roger Dean's artwork all over his album was that I think the story was his manager knew Roger Dean's manager or something like that, but someone in the industry knew Roger Dean and asked for permission for Ben to use the artwork, and that's what he's done. So you've got the amazing, sweeping, huge, sort of canyon-like, strange, organic/rock on the front of the album, and I always think it looks a little bit like a carcass as well. So it looks a bit like a rib cage,
some kind of
animal that's been slaughtered for the front mm-hmm. cover of this. And it also looks like a canyon, something like the Grand Canyon in America or something like that. It's one of his greatest artworks and makes a fantastic cover, I think. So Ben was very, very happy and obviously very, very lucky to be able to do that. And this is the only album cover that he's managed to get from Roger Dean, but he's actually moved on to Freya Dean, who is Roger's daughter, and he's used some of her fantastic artwork for other album covers. So, and you've got the Ben Craven logo and the name of the album, Great and Terrible Potions, done by Roger Dean as well. So he's designed those as he would for other bands, and that mm-hmm. looks fantastic on the album cover as well. And so you would expect the music to have some progressive elements, and it certainly does. And he calls himself a cinematic songwriter, singer-songwriter, progressive rock singer-songwriter in this cinematic style, and it is very much like that. Sometimes his music sounds a little bit like it should be from a James Bond movie. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's a sort of amalgamation of all sorts of different kinds of prog and classic rock. He is fully capable of soloing like Steve Howe, but also like Gilmore in a sort of Pink Floyd manner. And he plays the keyboards and he sticks in Hammond organ sounds as if he was Tony Kaye, and he puts in Moog solos like he's Rick Wakeman. But it's definitely not just a ripoff of Yes. It has its own very distinctive flavor and sound. And again, like John Anderson's Elias, this is created entirely by Ben. He's an absolute wizard at the modern techniques of Pro Tools or whatever it is that he uses, constructs it all from scratch and puts together orchestral arrangements and so on the computer. And I love the way the two songs from this album I've chosen. The first one's called Diabolique, and that segues straight into Nobody Dies Forever, Part 1. And just the grandeur, and cinematic, I think, is perfect because the scale of his music is enormous. And but also, it has a lot of contrast in it. So there are intimate, small moments interspersed with these huge soundscapes. And I think that's why the album cover, not only the fact that it's Roger Dean, but the subject of it as well, fits this music perfectly, because it's on an epic scale, this picture on the front and on the back of the Gatefold album. And I think it's just perfect for this music.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so firstly...
I got to totally agree.
I was just going to say, you totally blew my mind when you said that this is his thing on the side, because I would have assumed, listen to this, this is just professional, because this is... I mean, I do music on the side, and I'm not quite at this level. It's really cool. And my one note, I guess, because it's true, and it's good that you pointed out that it's not just, you know, a Yes clone, but it is almost the assumption you could fall into quite easily, given the use of Roger Dean art, which is, it's kind of a double-edged sword in that regard. You know, it, I mean, Roger Dean is Roger Dean, isn't he? His art is amazing. It's evocative. It's beautiful in its like complexity and its simplicity. But on the other side, side of the sword, as it were, you use a Roger Dean piece of artwork like that, and the assumption is this is going to be a Yes ripoff, which I'm so glad that we do not get here at all. It's a great cinematic again. It's a great description. It's definitely cinematic, and it's not a word used often, I guess, with progressive rock, and I think it's definitely used appropriately here. Weirdly, the only other song that I've really listened to and immediately thought this is cinematic is quite different, but it was Four Horsemen by Aphrodite's Child. I don't know what it is about that song, yeah. But I think there's something about, and we hear the same thing here, like the cleanliness of the production is part of what makes it so cinematic, and it's obviously epic. And yeah, it's totally the right description for him. But I did interrupt you there, Mark. So sorry if you go on with what you were going to say.
Well, that's fine. I mean, I wasn't sure what the order was going to be in discussing it. Ben Craven is somebody who's familiar to me. I do know of his music. I think actually Kevin might have been the one who introduced me to him years back. Maybe around this time of this record, actually, or around the time when he was discussing this album. Great stuff. Again, you make an excellent point, though, Jacob, about the fact that when you use Roger Dean, you fall into that possibility where now that you have that artwork on there, that people are going to right away think, oh, this is going to sound like Yes, you know, right away. And meanwhile, he's done stuff for people like Uriah Heep and other bands that are not necessarily Yes sounding as well, right? He's done lots of other bands that are so that of course that can happen, right? The music is fantastic. It is very cinematic, and it's ironic that you mentioned the fact that it could be in a James Bond film, because right away when I saw that title, Nobody Dies Forever Part One, the first thing that came to me is Diamonds Are Forever or No One Lives. You know, like away it sounds like a James Bond kind of title to it right away. The music is fantastic. I again appreciate this sort of music, mainly because of the fact that not only is it excellent and he's a great singer and stuff like that, but he's a great performer. On his Bandcamp, he has a couple of albums he released in October of last year, the Prague Australia Live album, which is him performing some stuff live at a club. And the way he does it, it's him and one other guy. And whatever they don't perform live on stage is done through the use of computer, right? So they play to a click. And it's great stuff, though. The trouble of playing with a click is that if you botch something up, you need to find need to find your way back onto the click. Otherwise, you're screwed, right?
Yes.
So it's an interesting thing to have to commit to, but he does it very well. It turned out excellent. I think the music is fantastic, and I think the artwork for this album cover is really good. In one way, when I first looked at it, it almost looked like, and I don't think this is the point. I don't think this is the case, but my first impression when I saw this was, is this one of these paintings that Roger did and said, you know, I don't know who to give this to. I'll just put it aside. And then, hey, this Ben bloke came along and maybe he can take it, you know, kind of thing. So I don't know if it was drawn or painted in with him in mind, or if it was just like a painting that
I think so.
You know, Ben liked it and they took it. Yeah, so I said, I don't know for certain, obviously, right?
But
I mean, and the interesting thing is, just to make a little interesting point about the influence of art, I use a guy who makes my album covers, and he is clearly influenced by Roger Dean, and I know he's told me it several times that he loves his paintings, and he was influenced as a painter by Roger Dean, and I'll just show you really quickly some of the stuff that done for me, and I'm sure you'll see the influence right away here. This is one of the first albums that he's done for me. I mean, not only is music influential, but the point I'm trying to make is that artwork itself could influence a lot of people and artists as well. So I mean, I know James, the guy who does my stuff, James McCarthy, I call him my Roger Dean because he's done every single album cover that I've needed for whenever I do my Project Gemini stuff. And you know, I think it's very important. I keep stressing it, that the artwork needs to kind of convey what the music does. And I think Ben does it really well here mm-hmm. with his music as well. I mean, I've listened to this album several mm-hmm. times. So when Kevin picked out Diabolik and Nobody Dies Forever Part 1, I was like, oh, this is great. I'm familiar with this stuff. So I could have talked about this record, no problem. And there's so many influences. And the thing that's interesting about it that Kevin brought up as well is that you would think, yes, right away, like musically is the influence, but mm-hmm. there's a lot of Pink Floyd in his music, mm. a lot of Pink Floyd mm. influence in there, probably a touch more than yes, I would say, on his music. So don't always judge your book by its cover, but it's kind of good to at least have a cover that is somewhat accurate to the music.
Yes, yeah, for sure. So one last note on this is that I did him playing live with only one other musician to replicate this to a click. The discipline needed for that is, I mean, you obviously know this, but that, I mean, I can record by myself in like my little home studio to a click because obviously you have to, but to do that live, oh, just the discipline and just, you have to be so on top of it. That is incredibly remarkable. And, you know, like, that combined with like really good songwriting sensibility as well, you know, it's a good combo of discipline and songwriting skill, which isn't, I don't think, comes naturally. I think a lot of the time when you get brilliant musicians, they're either one half or the other, and this guy's clearly got it both. So I need to listen to more of his stuff, because I didn't know of him at all. So thank you definitely for the recommendation on this one, Kevin. So on the subject of art matching the music, I'm hoping maybe my next choice does a better job than the Van Morrison album. So this is so I don't know tons about this artist necessarily, although I have seen him live a couple of years ago. This is Riley Walker, and the album is Golden Things That Have Been Sung, and the song is The Roundabout, which bears no relation whatsoever to Roundabout by Yes. And the artist is a Brooklyn-based illustrator, cartoonist, and musician called Brian Blomuth. I think that's how you pronounce it, Blomuth? I'm going to assume that's how it's... There's one O, so it's Blomuth, as far as I'm concerned. And so this song... Do I want to talk too much? I do tend to like to get people's opinions before I go off on one. So I'm curious what your guys' opinions on the artwork and the music itself.
Mm. Okay. Go ahead, Kevin, if you want to go first.
Oh, okay. I think the artwork is pretty much perfect for this music, actually. We've got the sun at sunset sort of melting into the ocean, as it were, and we've got some the moon in all its different phases and stars, a starry night with the sun going down, and I think it's absolutely perfect. It is that laid back, this music. It's mm-hmm. it's beautiful and well done, and I find myself really enjoying the 4 minutes and 41 seconds of it, and wanting to listen to it again once it had finished. You know, really restful, lovely music. Mark?
I'm glad you liked it.
Yeah, I mean, I have to totally agree, to be honest with you. I think the artwork is really well done. This one is definitely more in line with what I kind of thought it was going to be, because while this does have elements where you could say, yeah, this looks like a prog rock album, not so much, I find, for me, because the kind of colors that he used and the way, the kind of feeling I got off of it, it kind of did make me remind me more of psychedelia a little bit more and something a little bit more calmer in music, something a little bit more laid back in approach. And we definitely get that with this song, The Roundabout. It's very acoustic-y, very singer-songwrity sort of approach to it. And I really liked it. I thought the song was really well done. One thing I'm going to admit too is I did listen to the song about two or three times, because when I listened to it the first time, it went by so quickly. I was like, oh, it's done already. Let's listen to it again.
Yes.
So that's kind of a sign of a good song when you kind of, you know, get to the end of it and you're like, well, that's it, I want to hear it again. So I am going to probably seek out this record a little bit more to see if I like the rest of it, and of course, if it is to my liking, then of course I see here that it says it came out on a deluxe 2 LP version, so no, you know me and my vinyl, so if it's as good as I think it is, I'll probably go and try to snatch this if it's still available. Good singing, the acoustic playing is really nicely done. I thought the production is very well done too. I mean, that's the thing about these sort of stripped back singer-songwriter things, if you don't get the production right on this, it can be kind of disastrous, I think. I think that it needs to have that sort of vibe where you're kind of sunken into a sofa with, like, you know, 1,000 pillows around you that are all kind of really soft. Mm-hmm. And you kind of just sit there and you're like, oh, yeah, this is the stuff. And you kind of just listen to this music and just get into it fully immersed. Mm. You know what I mean? So, and yes. I think that that does it with this song. I don't know, Jacob, if you know the rest of this album, how it is, but if it's anything like this song, I think I might be interested.
Yeah. So he's generally a kind of folksy art rock kind of guy, I would guess. I would probably generalize that as. But it's interesting because I was recommended this by a friend a few years ago because he was playing here. I live in Bristol. He was playing in Bristol just a few months before it was recommended. And my friend said, well, do you want to come along? So I listened to it and I thought, this is great. I went to see him live. And some of the songs, even this one, like the way he arranges them and plays them live, like quite radically different at points. Like they become a lot more like not jazz fusion, but he like some of the instrument, like his guitar playing and other people in the band, like they add that element to a much larger extent than I ever would have imagined. Because hearing this song, my first thought is, you know, like Nick Drake, maybe John Martin, kind of British folk, bucolic, pastoral, laid back, all these things that we've just said already. And then live, it's a much more raucous at points, not invariably. But it was really interesting because he had, you know, quite a bit of like back and forth with the audience, and he was playing a black Stratocaster at one point, and he started making references to, you know, just copying David Gilmour and trying to, you know, be David Gilmour. And I've no idea. I was probably drunk at the time. I think we were kind of wholesomely heckling him in a nice way. And it turns out he's really into Genesis and into Yes. So, and I thought, wow, this is great. There was a weird bit of back and forth between my group and him on stage. But yeah, I really like it. I think his voice is great here. I really like the vibe. I like the match between the artwork and the music. Brian Blomuth, I've looked at a bit of his other art. He does quite a lot of wacky illustrations. They're always quite colourful. But this is kind of, some of it's maybe a bit too wacky for my personal taste. But this, I think he's really struck a balance between colourful, slightly otherworldly, but really matching the music, and really subtle in a kind of beautiful way as well. I really like it. And yeah, Riley Walker, it's kind of one of those things which is really, I'm getting to the age now, I'm 30, so I'm not that old, but he's 31, and it is getting a bit annoying seeing people do so well in music, and I'm just like, well, you know, I play a bit, but he's genuinely great. He just kind of makes me feel a little bit jealous, which is fine. It's just a sign of his talent, really. I would definitely recommend listening to the rest of this album. I really enjoyed it. And if I've not really looked for live performances on YouTube, but maybe you might find one. I'm sure he does lots of performances where he keeps the song very much in the original spirit, but maybe it was just the night we saw him, he really decided to really jazz it up. But there was some really surprising arrangements of his songs that which I thought was really great as well, because it's not something you really see from people just decide, you know, we're going to play it live totally different. But yeah, he's great. He's really genuinely good. But yeah, I mean, unless anyone had any other thoughts on any of the albums or a kind of general way of summing it up, I think we're coming towards the end of this podcast, unfortunately.
Yeah, no, I think that we've touched base on everything that we needed. I mean, I think the point that I tried to make throughout the whole podcast is that I think the association with art and music, for me, needs to be strong. I mean, I think the cover, in a lot of ways, is, I'm not going to say just as, almost as important as the music itself. Because, I mean, think.
We're losing you there, Mark.
Look at that. We've done quite well throughout the entire episode, and then we get to the end, and the connection seems to have gone a little bit.
Sorry. But I just wanted to agree with you, just to finish off, Mark. And if you think of every classic album, not just progressive rock album, but every classic album that you can think of, the vast majority of them have got really, if not good art, then they've got really recognizable and memorable covers. And you know, whether it's a Queen album, Greatest Hits, or whatever, the Yes albums with Roger Dean artwork. Generally speaking, I'm sure there are exceptions, but generally speaking, I think great albums have at least memorable, if not great, covers.
Yeah. I'm inclined to bring up my beloved Beach Boys again as a possible exception, because Pet Sounds.
Oh, yes.
The Pet Sounds point. Cover is it ended up memorable simply by a matter of fact of because of how popular the album now is. But it's really a bit disappointing, I think. But we don't need to go into that here. Do you guys want to tell us about your podcast again and point listeners in the direction of where they can find it?
Yeah. So it's the Yes Music Podcast, and you can get to it at yesmusicpodcast.com, where we've been since 2011. And we release episodes every Friday, pretty much every Friday. And as I say, we're approaching episode 500. And if you're available in August, have a look at the website, see exactly what date that is. Come and join us on the Top of Yes Tour to record that episode 500. You'd be very welcome to come and join us.
Awesome.
And, I don't know if can you guys hear me?
Yes, we can. Yeah. I was going to say, Mark, you may as well tell us a bit more about where we can find your music as well.
Okay. Yeah. So while I still have a connection, I'm going to say that you can find my stuff on Bandcamp. It's the Project Gemini stuff, right? And if you notice, it's spelled this way, not the way you would probably conventionally spell it.
E Y E.
Yes, and it's also a K instead of a C in the project too. So. So you can get all my music there. I do the Yes Music Podcast with Kevin every week. Great stuff. We enjoy doing it very much. I also do, believe it or not, a Kiss podcast with these guys called the Kiss FAQ Podcast with Julian Gill, who's probably one of the more renowned authors in the music world. We're coming up to almost, I think we've already passed 300 episodes, but yeah, we've done quite a lot of stuff too. So you can catch me there as well, the Kiss FAQ podcast. And I also do another group with a fellow UK musician named Joe Bailey. And that band is called The Dark Monarchy. And we're just working on our second album now, and that should be coming out rather soon. So there you go.
Awesome. Mark, you're a genuine 21st century Renaissance man. You're all over the place. This is amazing. For anyone listening, I'm on YouTube, I'm on Twitter, I'm on all the things as Big Yellow Praxis, or just look up my podcast on Spotify. Anywhere, really, you'll find it out there. It's on lots of platforms. Underrated, overhated. I talk about underrated music with people, you know. I talk about all kinds of music, but, you know, there's a lot of prog, a lot of folk, a lot of funk as well, a lot of psychedelia. But, you know, please check me out. And, you know, don't forget to subscribe and like on YouTube. But that brings us to the end of the episode. And I just want to thank both Kevin and Mark for their time and for their great conversation. And I think we've covered some really great albums here, some great album covers. Even if one of them wasn't quite appropriate to the music, I still think it's a great cover. thank you both for your time, and have a good evening. In fact, it's evening.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Thanks.